This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyas Wahib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
We have to get our act together and figure out how to approach these institutions, maybe as a collective. Then maybe they'll pay some attention to us. But as it is now, we also don't have alternatives. We don't have real alternatives.
That was Professor Kweku Nuama, senior professorial lecturer and chair of the International Peace and Conflict Resolution Program at American University in Washington on the International Monetary Fund and World Bank's annual meeting in Morocco. Details coming up. Also, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken is on a diplomatic push to help prevent a wider war in the Middle East. And a Nairobi court this week temporarily suspended a Kenyan government plan to deploy 1,000 police officers to Haiti. These stories and more on African News Tonight. But first, our top story. The death toll is nearing 3,000 in the fighting between Israel and Hamas troops. Israel's military has warned more than 1 million residents of the northern part of Gaza to flee to the south within 24 hours, apparently ahead of plans for a ground invasion of the region. International aid groups and the United Nations have warned that the short notice on the evacuation will endanger many civilians. VOA correspondent Heather Murdoch is now in Israel. We have her on the line now for an update on the latest developments and what she has seen. Welcome, Heather.
Thank you.
So first tell us where you are and what you are seeing around you.
Well, right now I just arrived in Jerusalem near the Old City. I just came from the West Bank and Ramallah. There have been clashes on and off all day long today. And we saw a very tense area with fires left over. There was some gunshots and rocks throwing. And the clashes had quieted as we were leaving. We were also in an area where men from Gaza, you may know that something like 20 to 25,000 workers from Gaza generally work in Israel proper, and many of those men were caught outside of the Gaza Strip when the war began. So hundreds of them were in a center, a municipality that has been made into a makeshift shelter. And the atmosphere there was just of sheer despair. I mean, almost to the level that people were talking about suicide, where the Israeli government has told the people in Gaza to evacuate, move south. There's nowhere to leave. You can't actually get out of Gaza, but they said some of their families tried to move south, but there was shelling on the roads. They couldn't get on the roads. And they're afraid that there will be even further onslaught in the next 24 hours.
And for the last 6 days, Israel warplanes have pounded Gaza with airstrikes. Can you talk to us a little about Israel's response? It has been very swift and relentless.
Yes. As one person pointed out to me today, that this is a very unusual affair. This conflict has been going on for a very long time, longer than you and I have been around for sure. But normally the death toll is not so high on both sides. There's some 1,300 Israelis have been killed. The onslaught came initially from Hamas, and it came into Israeli towns and cities and kibbutzes, and some of the deaths were brutal. Bodies were found en masse. And their reaction has been swift and ruthless and relentless. The pounding of Gaza with bombs goes on day and night from a kilometer away. You can see it. And the people inside are, one guy was telling me today that his wife and children have, as he said, surrendered. They just believe they're going to stay in their homes until they die there. But I've also spoken to Israeli civilians as well. And as far as they're concerned, this is an existential threat. And the level of support for the army in this very strong and fast response is high. And some people even think it should be more.
And, you know, the Biden administration is saying that it is working very diligently with Israel and Egypt on safe passage out of Gaza for civilians. Do you think that will ever happen?
Well, I don't know. I mean, is he? Like, what exactly is does that mean? We've been talking about this all day long. Like, what exactly is safe passage out of Gaza going to mean? Where to Egypt? I mean, Egypt has had the opportunity to open those gates to Gaza citizens many times during conflicts and has declined since 2007. Egypt and Hamas are no friends. And, of course, it's not Hamas members that need to get out. It's civilians. But it has kept that southern border closed for a long time. So does this mean a safe passage perhaps through Israel to the West Bank? To be honest, I don't know what they are thinking could be done. And if it is going to be done, I'm hoping they're thinking it should be done now. Like, there's no time to delay. People are dying en masse so fast, and we expect the war to get much stronger very soon.
And lastly, Heather, Hamas militants are holding as many as 150 people hostage in locations across Gaza. And earlier this week, they warned that they would start killing hostages if Israel continues its bombardment of Gaza.
Yes, and we've heard that the Hamas leadership says they won't discuss releasing hostages until Israel stops attacking Gaza, and that is not going to happen. The Israeli military has shown no signs of being willing to stop the attacks. And the families of the hostages are distraught. The longer this goes on, the less hope they have that it's going to turn out in their favor. Some people have already found the bodies of their loved ones whom they thought were hostages, but they were actually killed in the conflict itself. But there are many people that are believed to be alive inside of Gaza, held hostage. And until some kind of political solution is come, maybe not for the entire conflict or even this part of the war, but some kind of dialogue or political solution for some part of this conflict is reached, these people seem to be stuck in a situation that must be terrifying.
VOA correspondent Heather Murdoch, please stay safe. Thank you.
Thank you.
U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken is on a diplomatic push to help prevent a wider war in the Middle East, traveling to Israel, Jordan, Qatar, Saudi Arabia, and the United Arab Emirates. Cindy Sain has the story.
U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken has met with Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas and Jordan's King Abdullah in Amman, Jordan, at the start of a packed day, which will also take him to Qatar, Bahrain, and Saudi Arabia. The Jordanian king called for opening humanitarian corridors to allow for the entry of urgent medical and relief aid to Gaza and protecting civilians as Israel seeks to destroy Hamas' operating capacity in Gaza. Cindy Sain, VOA News.
Meanwhile, U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin has been in Israel today. His visit comes just days after the United States sent an aircraft carrier strike group in the eastern Mediterranean and additional fighter aircraft to the Middle East. Israel is also getting U.S. munitions and support for its Iron Dome air defense. Some Middle East experts say if Israel's operations in Gaza turn into a much wider campaign to occupy large sections of the area and attempt to fully uproot Hamas, then Hezbollah, with Iran's blessing, might choose to open a second front. The USS Gerald Ford Strike Group, which includes an aircraft carrier, a guided missile cruiser, and guided missile destroyers, is in the eastern Mediterranean. And President Biden delivered a warning to other actors in the region. To anyone thinking of taking advantage of the situation, I have one word: don't. Amer Hamzawi, director of Carnegie Middle East Program, discussed these developments with VOA senior analyst Mohammed Al-Shinawi.
I believe as of now, other parties are not interested in engaging in the kind of escalation between Israel and Gaza. Hezbollah has been restrained. Other actors have been restrained. So I do not see any signs of this regional behavior changing. There is a great deal of showing support on the side of the Biden administration toward Israel of sending out regional messages. But the real messages are not being sent. The real messages are what will come next. We have in the prospects of a political settlement. I guess the big lesson which U.S. policymakers should see in the tragic unfolding events in the region is without a clear political solution for the Palestinian issue, this region will never have enough stability to create a momentum for regional normalization between Israel and many Arab states as far as Morocco and Bahrain and Saudi Arabia. This region will never have enough stability to have sustained human development in its key societies. And I'm afraid that the administration, the Biden administration, is responding in a hardly reactive manner in which it's sending out warnings and signals, fine, that we're in the political solution. Are we not going to go back to a restoration of the peace process or the two-state solution, or what kind of diplomatic solutions are going to be put on the table to find a way out? Because this is, as tragic as it is, only a new way in a violence cycle that has been going on for so many years.
From a strategic point of view, what kind of impact would an Israeli ground offensive have on stability in the Middle East?
The current escalation between Israel and Hamas is impacting the region in many different ways. One, it's creating regional fears that truly divert attention from key challenges that we have, from climate change to human development to difficult economic and social situations and conditions in so many countries. So there's a great deal of attention diversion. Second, it also is an opportunity for everyone in the region and outside to remember that this region will not find its way to stability without solving the Palestinian issue. That no matter what Israel and its right wing governments claim in terms of ignoring Palestine or normalizing everyone else at the cost and at the expense of making peace with Palestine, that this issue will keep coming back and haunting everyone in the region. So it's a reminder of how important it is to find policy solutions, not ad hoc solutions, not only security-driven solutions, but policy solutions that cater to legitimate Palestinian rights of self-determination and national aspirations.
Do you foresee any role for the Arab League to help de-escalation?
I mean, all Arab actors, including the Arab League, are trying to remind everyone of how important the two-state solution is, as key to the effort of Arabs based on the principle of land in return for peace. Unfortunately, there were no efforts due to Israeli refusal with regard to the peace process throughout the last years. The last meeting between Israeli and Palestinian officials, if I'm mistaken, took place in 2014 or 2015. So I hope, once again, with all the tragic question, tragic loss of life that we're seeing, that after that, Israel policymakers will reconsider their way of managing the question of Palestine. Nothing will happen in the region at the expense of Palestine. Its stability will not be guaranteed at the expense of Palestine. So we have to figure out a policy solution. And Arabs are actually ready in the sense of having put forward a peace initiative and being restored and being in favor of a peace process where talks can be relaunched with an all of external powers, including the U.S., China, Russia, and the Europeans.
That was Amar Hamzawi, director of the Carnegie Middle East Program, speaking with VOA's Mohammed Al-Shinawi. You're listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. This week, the International Monetary Fund and World Bank held their annual meetings in Africa for the first time in 50 years. Both are facing a growing chorus of criticism that poorer nations are unrepresented at the two institutions. The world's most powerful economic policymakers say they will focus on Africa as they work to grow and stabilize the global economy. Is that feasible? Is the first question I pose to Professor Kweku Nuama, Senior Professorial Lecturer and Chair of the International Peace and Conflict Resolution Program at American University here in Washington.
It's feasible to the extent that the Africans have significant input into how these decisions are made. And because Africans mostly show up as borrowers and beggars, and you really don't have that much leverage when you're dealing with somebody from that position of weakness. And so we have to get our act together and figure how to approach these institutions, maybe as a collective, then maybe they'll pay some attention to us. But as it is now, we also don't have alternatives. We don't have real alternatives to these banks. And so we take the terms as they are given. You could go to the private market, but the private markets are going to cost you more because most African countries have really, really poor sovereign credit rating. And so when you don't handle your business at home, and inflation runs rampant and your monetary policy is all over the place, and it affects your sovereign credit rating, you pay more to borrow money on the commercial market. So the international financial institutions, to the extent that they are more willing to work with you to help you get back on the proper track, even as they lend you money, become the only option available to countries that are really, really serious about not just getting development financing, but more importantly, fixing the underlying problems that make them vulnerable.
Professor, and keeping up with the high interest loans in Africa means, you know, less money for critical needs, youth and infrastructure.
Absolutely, because debt servicing eats into our monies that we could direct towards education, healthcare, investment for the future. We are using that money to pay not even the principals of the loans, but the interest. A lot of African countries spend a lot of money paying the interest on the loans, and that becomes a problem. And so we need a plan. And if you are serious, that's the thing. You need to have the political commitment to actually follow through the reforms and be frugal. Don't go do crazy expenditure whilst you owe money. But that's not how a lot of leaders think in Africa, especially in election years when they have to spend money to win elections. So when they think they are going to lose an election, and they go on the borrowing binge so that they can, you know, loot public resources and go away in case they lose elections. So it takes commitment, it takes seriousness, and it takes citizens getting involved so that our leaders know that we understand what's going on, we're paying attention. And when leaders work these shady deals in back rooms, we hold them accountable so that they don't accept loans with really, really horrible terms. Because in the end, it's the youth that end up paying these loans.
And lastly, Professor, what is this? These two institutions, the IMF and the World Bank, they plan to give Africa additional seats on their executive boards. Will that make any difference?
It's a beginning, I guess. If you have more votes on the boards, it helps. But it's a drop in the bucket. It's the right kind of drop, but it's a drop in the bucket. Now, the bigger question is, why is the president of the World Bank always from the United States and the president of the IMF always from Europe?
That was Professor Kweku Nuama, senior professorial lecturer and chair of the International Peace and Conflict Resolution Program at American University in Washington. A Nairobi court this week temporarily suspended a Kenyan government plan to deploy 1,000 police officers to Haiti. The case was brought to court by three petitioners, including opposition politician and constitutional lawyer Ikuru Ikot, who told VOA that proposed deployment was unconstitutional. Analysts say there may be a way for the government to argue its case. VOA Nairobi Bureau Chief Maria Madialo has the story.
The ruling by the High Court of Kenya puts a hold on the deployment of police officers to Haiti or any other country pending another hearing scheduled for October 24th. This will allow government officials to respond to the arguments made against them in the petition, the ruling shared with VOA says. The petitioners include opposition politician and constitutional lawyer Ekuru Aukot. He told VOA that although he cannot really discuss a matter that is actively in court, he maintains that the government's plan to send 1,000 of its police to Haiti is not in line with the constitution.
The whole thing is very unprocedural. It is unconstitutional. And for me, as a person who sat in the committee of experts as the CEO to direct the writing of our current constitution, of course, it behoves me to be able to actually point out and constitutional decisions.
The UN Security Council last week approved a Kenya-led multinational security force aimed at helping the troubled Caribbean nation. While many in Kenya question their country's lead role in this mission, some have been supportive of President William Ruto. He says it's a mission for humanity and is of special significance and critical urgency for Kenyans. A representative from the Ruto government told us on Tuesday that the government will argue its case and abide by the court's decision. Meanwhile, in the petition shared with VOA, Aucott cites two articles in the Kenyan constitution. They say that only Kenya Defense Forces can be deployed to another country and that the National Police Service will only function throughout Kenya. But
there is a sort of an inkling in Section 107 and 108 of the National Police Service Act. And it says the National Police may, it's very discretionary, may be deployed, but it has to be upon a request from a reciprocating government. And that's what one of the gists of the question that we are raising, which I don't want to discuss in details because it's a matter for determination.
Haiti did ask for help, but didn't ask Kenya specifically, and there is no reciprocal agreement between the two governments. Francis Khayundi, assistant professor of international law at the United States International University Africa in Nairobi, told VOA. Khayundi says the court's decision is in line with the petitioner's argument on what processes had not been followed.
For me, looking at the petition and looking at what the laws provide, it makes sense because as it is, procedure was not followed, or better yet, not all information is being given that would make us know why Kenya is getting involved.
But Khayundi notes there may be a way for the government to make its case.
Actually, there's provision for the police force to be deployed outside the country. However, this is a decision that has to be taken by the National Security Council, and it is informed by Article 240 of the Kenyan Constitution. So far, we have not heard of any decision being taken by the National Security Council to deploy the police. So I think that is where the issue is.
He says the NSC is a body established by the Constitution that includes the president, his deputy, a few cabinet secretaries, the attorney general, the director general of the National Intelligence Service, and the inspector general of the National Police Service. And so far, they've only mostly heard from the president and a few cabinet secretaries making the case for deployment. Mariama Diallo, VOA News, Nairobi.
The Democratic Republic of Congo says it will gradually roll back military administration and end a curfew in two eastern provinces where the government has been battling armed groups. In a televised address to the nation, President Felix Tshisekedi declared a gradual and progressive easing of the emergency measures in North Kivu and Ituri, including a transition back to civilian governance. He said the transitional arrangement will consist of re-establishing civilian authority in the decentralized and deconcentrated territorial entities that are already secured under the control of the DRC armed forces. The state of siege was imposed on the provinces in May 2021 in an effort to end violence and restore order. The president's announcement comes just ahead of a December 20 poll in which he is seeking re-election. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, and our engineer, Cedric Franklin, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.